And actually, that introduction is more directly related to what I spoke about last year, but we'll talk about bright futures just a little bit today. Today, I'm mostly going to speak about supporting healthy children, building relationships, and promoting care coordination between child care and the primary care medical home. And I have no relationships to disclose. I want to thank the American Academy of Pediatrics and their Healthy Child Care America initiative, which funded some of the activities I'll speak about today, and also my colleagues at the Illinois chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics for the insight that they gained from their work with the maternal and infant and early childhood home visiting project. Today I'll be hopefully teaching you to identify the link between the medical home and child care and early education professionals. You should be able to describe our efforts in Illinois to strengthen relationships between child care providers and medical homes. And you should be able to explain the benefits of using a standardized information sharing form in communications between child care and primary care settings. So first I want to just define my terms and also talk about why building relationships between child care providers and medical homes is so important to child health. So what is a medical home? Hopefully you've heard this term before. It's a source of comprehensive and continuous medical care. It's more of a concept and not necessarily a set physical location, though it certainly can be the set physical location that serves as a patient's source of regular care. But really, the medical home uses a team-based approach to, you know, together with different kinds of healthcare providers, physicians, nurses, MAs, PAs, to provide care to patients with the goal of optimizing health outcomes in a culturally and linguistically appropriate manner. And medical homes facilitate partnerships between the individual patients, their medical providers, and when appropriate, the patient's family. Some of the different techniques that medical homes may use to support care include registries, information technology, health information exchanges, and other types of means to assure that patients get the indicated care when and where they need it. So who are early education and child care professionals? We already know this from your work and from the other speakers today, but they provide care to children birth through age 5, though the content of the care may vary. They may or may not have formal training or education or experience in child care, in early education, in child development, cognitive development, and they may or may not have training in a particular agency's model, practices, or protocols. There's quite a few different types of child care options in Illinois. We have licensed and license-exempt child care centers, licensed and license-exempt family child care homes, in-home care, Head Start, Early Head Start, and Preschool for All. For this mentioned already today as well, but with 60 to 70% of children younger than 6 years regularly attending some type of out-of-home child care or early education program, clearly the quality of the care that's received is really critical. And so the American Academy of Pediatrics put out a policy statement in 2005, which they reaffirmed in 2009, called Quality Early Education and Child Care from Birth to Kindergarten. In this policy statement, the AAP emphasizes that high-quality early education and child care for young children can improve their health and promote their development and learning. They further state that pediatricians and other pediatric health care providers have an important role to play in improving access to quality early education and child care in their communities, both by assisting patients individually in helping families to make their child care decisions, but also in advocating more broadly for policies that improve access and quality for everyone. However, in many states, and this includes Illinois, interaction between child care providers and medical homes may be limited, and true three-way partnerships between families, child care providers, and primary care providers often is not occurring. So the AAP calls for increased interaction between child care providers and medical homes and efforts to improve the relationship between them. Enhancing this relationship has many benefits for child health. When primary care providers are more aware of child care options, they can encourage families to seek out high-quality early education and child care in their communities and help them in their decision-making. Connection with a child care provider can give the medical home a view into the family's day-to-day life, which can be critical for providing quality care. And then on the other end, child care providers can play a key role in reinforcing anticipatory guidance that the family may be receiving from their pediatric care provider, and can also help prepare families for well child visits and for other medical appointments. And finally, connection with a medical home offers child care providers a place to go with questions about health and safety topics. So what is the Illinois chapter of the AAP doing to build relationships and support care coordination between child care providers and medical homes? We have been taking a three-pronged approach based on past successes collaborating with early intervention and working with home visiting programs. So we sought to strengthen relationships between child care providers and medical homes by leading medical home-led trainings to child care providers on key health topics, including medication administration, developmental screening, and care coordination. We're providing opportunities for interaction and relationship building, including written and oral communication and direct interaction. And then we've also developed and disseminated resources and tools to encourage and enable care coordination, including a standardized information sharing form that I'll show to you today that incorporates parental consent. So I want to start by discussing a couple of our training efforts. One important health and safety issue that we've been training on is medication administration. Pediatricians and other medical home staff have been delivering a curriculum developed by the American Academy of Pediatrics throughout the state of Illinois. And this training on medication administration includes information on preparing, administering, and documenting medication in early education and child care settings. We've partnered with the Child Care Resource and Referral Agencies in our state to organize these trainings, and we've held a large number throughout Illinois this year, and we're also going to hopefully, as the AAP is currently working on a Spanish version, and we're hopefully going to be able to roll that out in Cook County in 2014. Another way we've been offering training to child care providers is by partnering with Illinois Action for Children, which is an excellent advocacy organization, as well as the Child Care Resource and Referral Agency for Cook County. And we've partnered with them to connect their child care providers to existing online trainings on topics such as developmental screening and referral, care coordination principles, and other topics on early childhood and family screening. These trainings are currently housed on the website from our Enhancing Developmentally Oriented Primary Care Project, which is another project of the Illinois chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. And we're currently updating these trainings as well, and they'll soon be on a different platform, so you're welcome, anyone who wants to take these trainings for free right now. You can go ahead at edopc.net, but they'll look a little bit different in the future. A third training topic has been Bright Futures, which, for those who are not familiar, is a national health promotion model developed by HRSA along with AAP. It addresses children's health needs in the context of family and community and recommends a comprehensive set of wellness and preventive health services for children from birth through age 21, and is generally considered to be the gold standard for well child care. As you heard mentioned, our chapter is also working on incorporating Bright Futures into Illinois' Medicaid policy and provider handbook. That's another effort that I have been working on. And the reason for this effort is that under the Affordable Care Act, a number of preventive services are to be available to patients without any copays or cost sharing. And for children, those services are those which are identified in Bright Futures. But with all of that in mind, one of our efforts is also to include trainings on Bright Futures guidelines for child care providers. And by providing some training to child care providers on well child visits, they can help families know what to expect at these pediatric care visits, and they can help provide messaging to families that's consistent with Bright Futures. And finally, this is an upcoming initiative, but Our chapter recently received a grant to begin the PROTECT initiative, Promoting Resiliency of Trauma-Exposed Communities Together. And this will be a HRSA-funded grant to mitigate toxic stress and trauma in infancy and early childhood. We'll be working with our state's early childhood comprehensive system to build community capacity and work across systems. And a component of this grant will be to assess what's currently out there in terms of existing trainings on related topics such as trauma, toxic stress, adverse childhood experiences, and ensure that there's some consistency of definitions and messaging in the trainings for different systems so that some of the language used for primary care providers, child care providers, home visitors, it is very similar. We haven't yet delivered any trainings to child care providers specific to these topics, but as we assess what's currently out there for child care providers around these topics, we'll certainly be looking to help fill the gaps by developing or delivering trainings as necessary. We're also always looking to assess what future training needs child care providers may have, so we've participated in writing questions for the Illinois Network of Child Care Resource and Referral Agencies survey, and are also going to be partnering with Illinois Action for Children to assess training needs. So far, some of the suggested topics that we've heard from child care providers include EpiPen usage, food allergies, and asthma, which none of which are actually included in the AAP's Medication Administration training, and also child abuse, neglect, and trauma, toxic stress, and children's mental health, which hopefully through our new PROTECT initiative we'll have opportunities to provide some training on those. The second part of approach has been increasing interaction and raising awareness. So we've contributed to articles in our own publication and our website and other communications to raise awareness among medical homes of the different child care options, let them know about the AAP policy I mentioned, data about child care in Illinois, and techniques that they can use to support families in their child care decision making. We've also created opportunities for direct interaction. So some of that comes through the trainings that I've mentioned, which are typically led by medical home staff. And also we have a committee on early education and child care, and we'll also have some subcommittees from the PROTECT grant, all of which bring together both medical providers and child care providers. I have to say, our pediatricians have found these opportunities for interaction to be invaluable. They have gained insight into the needs, both in terms of knowledge and resources that child care providers have. They've gotten a much better sense of the different program models out there, the requirements, what types of medical information different programs need. You know, what does Head Start require of pediatricians versus what does another program require? And also what resources child care providers have at their disposal. For example, we recently learned that some Head Start programs have access to nutrition counseling, and this was really a very helpful finding for some of our medical providers who serve a lot of kids who are in Head Start programs, and there could be a lot of synergies by knowing that the child potentially has access to some nutrition counseling through their child care. Similarly, opportunities for direct interaction through trainings and committees has been extremely valuable for the child care providers. They've obviously gained a lot of direct knowledge through the trainings that we've provided, but beyond even the content learned, many of these providers have really found it to be helpful just to interact with pediatricians. They say they felt more connected and less intimidated by medical providers through some of these trainings. And several expressed how warm and welcoming the pediatricians and medical home staff who have delivered trainings are, and that made them feel more comfortable in the future going to medical providers if they have a question, if they aren't sure about, you know, exclusion for contagious diseases, or if they have a question about a health or safety topic, or a concern that they may have about a child or family. So that's very sort of affirming to hear. In addition, of course, we've been connecting child care providers to a variety of health-related resources from the AAP and other organizations, and I'm happy to share any of those afterwards with anyone who's interested. Finally, we've also worked to encourage and improve care coordination. There are many definitions of care coordination, but the one I'll be using today is a client-centered, assessment-based, interdisciplinary approach to integrating healthcare and social support services. And with care coordination, an individual's needs and preferences are assessed, a comprehensive care plan is developed, and services are managed and monitored by an identified care coordinator following evidence-based standards of care. We've been encouraging use of some sort of standardized care coordination form because it aids in sharing important information among professionals, including information about health concerns and about referrals that have been made. It also encourages the use of consistent anticipatory guidance and messaging that can reinforce information rather than confusing the information. It enables both child care and primary care providers to offer additional support to the family when they know what supports the family is already receiving. It incorporates the family's informed consent, and it relieves the family of the burden of information sharing among different providers. And that shouldn't be interpreted to say that we want to take families out of the loop, but just that, you know, families are already very overburdened, and to have them be the sole locus of responsibility for sharing information among providers, that's an extra burden on families. So in our work, we've recommended to child care sites that they develop some sort of care coordination or information sharing protocol. It doesn't have to be this, but our suggested care coordination process starts with the child care provider completing a standardized form, either just as a general request to communicate with the medical home, for example, to receive, you know, medical records or immunization records, or to communicate specific concerns that the child care provider may have. The parent or guardian signs the form sent to the medical home, and then using this form, the medical home and childcare site can go back and forth to share screening results, information about referrals made to community resources, concerns related to the child and family's well-being, and other pertinent medical information. This is just a screenshot of part of the form that we're using. It was modeled after forms that have been in use with early intervention and with home visiting programs in Illinois. And the form includes family contact information, reasons for contact, the child care site's contact information, the primary care provider's contact information, and of course an authorization to release information. I just want to note about the authorization to release information. This component of our form has been vetted for compliance with HIPAA, which governs privacy in medical records, and also FERPA, which governs privacy in school records. The consent is to share specific information, so if there's a concern about developmental screening, the information sharing can go back and forth on the topic of developmental concerns, but not necessarily if there's a new emergent concern. And the consent to share information about that specific topic is effective for a period of 12 months. And I'm happy to share the sample form that we have with anyone who's interested. So in summary, our chapter took a three-pronged approach to strengthening relationships between child care providers and medical homes. We've been organizing medical home-led trainings to child care providers, providing opportunities for interaction and relationship building between these two provider populations, and developing and disseminating tools that encourage and enable care coordination and information sharing. We feel the use of a standardized information sharing form can really enhance communications between child care and medical homes and benefit all parties, child care providers, medical providers, and of course, most importantly, children and their families. By increasing accurate and timely data sharing, encouraging consistent communication, messaging, and anticipatory guidance, lessening family burden, expanding family opportunity for access to important services and supports, and incorporating family consent. Thank you.
Great. At this time, let's go ahead and open it up for some questions. Anyone have any questions?
Yeah. I just wanted to mention, actually, that I have, we're going to hand out some, the National Association for Pediatric Nurse Practitioners put together a, what we're calling like a bookmark, of what are quality indicators in childcare, and we just want you to have a copy of that. And it was really developed for people working in primary care offices, so it would be very good for AAP. And it's something that you can also download for free off of the website, which is NAPNAP. So we just wanted to give you an evidence-based handy guide for quality indicators in childcare. So Jennifer's handing them out right now. Thanks. For what family daycare were you saying?
Oh.
Right. It's a great question about the family daycare homes. The way we looked at the checklist right now is that we wanted to pilot test it in child care centers. There's larger groups of children, and it was an easier place to have access right now. But we definitely think that it should be also relevant, and we need to test it in family child care. What we have been doing just informally is that we know our child care consultants that were involved in this pilot study also go out to family child care homes, and they've also made some comments about some of the items that would be really relevant and more frequent in family child care homes, and they're not frequent in child care centers. So we're discussing that as we decide which items to delete or which ones to keep. So for example, there was one item about trampolines, and they're really not frequently seen in child care centers, but they are more frequent in family child care homes. So it was a question of, do we keep it in the checklist? Because in the end, we would like the checklist to be relevant to both groups. So those are things that we're looking at, but we didn't include them in the pilot study. Yeah. The total population of the listservs in terms of? No, it's a good question on the response rate. I probably don't have that offhand, but it was, but I did look at it. I think it was about 30% response rate. And I would say that we went to the listservs that we knew were with the places where child care health consultants were going to be more likely to be enrolled in those listservs. So there were national ones, and then there were specific state ones. Yeah. Thanks. Well, one thing is that the pilot checklist is still being revised, so it's not available yet on our website. So our plan is it would probably be in January that it will be there. But it's UCSFchildcarehealth.org, all one word. And I would assume that the slides are going to be available to you.
They will be.
Yeah, they're available if you're, yeah, all of our slides should be available on APHA's website.
Since you're still standing there, then we'll let you use the slides maybe. But
okay.
Are there some differences between the previous version of the checklist and the new one that?
Yeah, there's a lot of differences between the previous checklist and the new one. Well, first of all, the biggest thing is that because the Caring for Our Children third edition is so different than the second, that the biggest things is there's about 147 new standards in the third edition of Caring for Our Children that really look completely different in the second edition. So it's really been updated. There's also 17 new appendices. The biggest area that I feel like that has really changed in Caring for Our Children is nutrition and physical activity, and some issues on behavioral health also. And so we really captured that in the checklist that we're using right now. And so we really didn't use the items, very, very few items, I would say, that are exactly the same from the last checklist that we had to this one. We really updated the way the wording is. The other was that we also changed the way we do rating. It used to be that in our last checklist, we would say either you meet the standard or you don't. And this time we wanted to give the child care health consultants and the directors more room for even what you're doing right, but might not be exactly perfect yet, but you're on your way to getting to meet the standard. So we had four levels so that you could say that sometimes they're meeting the standard, like it might be some classrooms that are meeting the standard, some kids are washing their hands right and some aren't, rather than saying the whole center doesn't do hand washing correctly, or you know, a yes, no. So we have this gradation now. So that's another part that's really different.
Rachel, did you want to address any
anything about the consent form, any additional?
I wanted to give you an opportunity.
Okay.
Unless you have additional.
Okay. Yes, in the front.
I have a question for both Dan and Rachel. What does it mean in there to establish collaboration between Amawati and community? I'm there in India, healthcare for different doctors, and the barrier for the collaboration between your care and home and community under research healthcare research.
So you are asking about the barrier between the collaborations between community health workers and Anganwadi workers? Anganwadi is essentially a government is a government service. So I'm community people. I think the first thing is the trust that they have to gain from the community, that the work they are doing is essentially going to the community and having a big impact on the health of the children, and helping them with the nutrition rates as well. The second thing which I would think about in terms of barrier is that they need to understand the importance of education. For example, even if it's hand washing, a lot of people would not clean their hands while cooking or going to the community toilets. So it was one of the major things that the Anganwadi workers told us, that they felt that the people would not understand until unless there was some sort of evidence or some sort of some community champion who would propel this forward. So I would say that the trust and the evidence that the education they were giving works, that were the two main barriers.
I think trust could also certainly apply when trying to bring together medical providers and child care providers in the U.S. Certainly, they don't necessarily always have like organic opportunities to interact with each other. And I think especially with differences in education and with the fact that they don't necessarily spend a lot of time together, it can be a little bit challenging to bring them together on the same page. But when you actually do, they realize that, of course, everyone has the exact same goal, which is, you know, healthy, safe children. So it really, it's a very natural partnership when you can get them in a safe space together to actually talk about anything, but that doesn't necessarily happen on its own. So having a third party, which in this case, you know, we served in that role by having there be opportunities for interaction, that can really be very helpful in terms of breaking down the barriers and having there be a way for child care providers and medical providers to actually speak to each other. And the other thing I would want to say is that while the trainings led by pediatricians were a very valuable form of interaction, we also do see our committees and some of these other opportunities that maybe put people on a little bit more of an equal playing field to be another valuable source of interaction, because, you know, there is a didactic dynamic when you have a training, and even though child care providers raved on their evaluations about how warm and inviting the pediatricians were and how non-intimidating it was, I think it's still nice to also have opportunities that are a little bit more egalitarian and put everybody on an equal playing field. Sure. So the Child Care Resource and Referral Agencies do training anyway with child care providers, so that's why we partnered with them, because they're already scheduling training for certification or just for, you know, continuing education for child care providers throughout the state. So some of them hold trainings in community centers, some of them hold them in their offices or in different types of spaces, libraries. It was wherever they normally hold their trainings for child care providers. So we really went straight to the Child Care Resource and Referral Agencies and said, you know, we have this 3 to 5 hour curriculum. Do you do that on two-hour sessions? Do you do that on a Saturday morning? What is your normal venue? How many people do you normally get? How do you normally make it work? And just kind of listen to them, and however they wanted to schedule it to get the most child care providers was what we did.
Do you have pediatricians providing this training? And if so, how did you recruit them? And did you do it with stipends?
Yeah, we did give them a stipend, and we did recruit them through our listserv, through our regular communications methods with our chapter members. We also had a few nurses, I'll note, that did the training as well, so we really thought of it as medical home, not just pediatricians, but it was mostly pediatricians. And we also had a few that were not exclusively primary care pediatricians. We had one who was a pediatric hospitalist, which she found this a great opportunity to get to do a little bit more, of a kind of different interaction than she normally has. Yes, we did provide a stipend because this was a grant from the AAP, so we had the opportunity to do so, and that also enabled us to kind of lay the groundwork and devote staff time to partnering with the child care resource and referral agencies. Yeah, so child care nurse consultants in Illinois, some areas of the state still have them and some do not due to funding. So there's kind of a big discrepancy in different regions of the state in terms of which have formal child care health consultation and which do not. Part of the medication administration training that we were rolling out from the AAP, of course, is based on the Caring for Our Children standards, and it we do refer to and encourage child care centers to all have a child care health consultant, but because some of the formal structure that was in place doesn't exist in some of the service delivery areas in the state, we just encourage them to, partner with a local pediatrician or partner with someone to have this as a resource for your site if a formal child care health consultant is not currently available. And I don't know if you have any thoughts or advice on sort of how to formalize that or, what we can do to encourage. Certainly, I will be looking at your checklist and trying to see how we can roll that out in future trainings, because I think that would be of huge value and a really easy way for us to bring together these populations and encourage kind of a simple quality and safety assessment.
Any other questions? Yes.
In the middle. So with regard to physiological nutrition, how closely aligned are your checklist with the Let's Move child care checklist that they're using?
Let's Move child care is based on caring for our children.
Yep.
So it's well aligned, actually. So we use Let's Move child care checklist and we use Go Knapsack as the assessment tools for the collaboratives. And actually in the FOA that was issued by the CDC when we received the cooperative agreement, it calls on starting with Let's Move child care checklist as a way of aligning and then really trying to get to caring for our children. Let's Move child care only has 15 to 18 measures on it. Obviously, Caring for Our Children has significantly more measures on it. I will say from the data from Let's Move child care, there have been over 11,000 providers signed up on Let's Move child care. There have been about 7,000 that have taken the quiz. About 75% are meeting 50% or more of best practices. There's only about 600 that are meeting all of the best practices, and that's self-report. So we have, both a real gap between a provider's desire to make a change. They're going online, they're trying to do this change, they want to do it, and their ability to do so. And I think it's interesting that when Let's Move Child Care launched, one of the biggest concerns was that there would be people with a reporting bias that would lean towards saying that I'm doing this even though I'm not, and we have not seen that. So I think there's a real desire to make the types of changes. So having checklists like yours that could then help promote the idea that providers could go in there and know what their changes are, that's what the intent was for Let's Move Child Care. That's what the intent is for the collaborative, is to provide that structure to help them get to those best practices. But
I should actually do a crosswalk. I'll do that to look at. I've looked at Let's Move, the items, and they're very similar to ours because both of ours is based on the exact same Caring for Our Children standards. But we might have picked a little few different nuances, but they're very similar.
I'm just curious because Allison, we actually know each other, but I thought you had the PR. I'm just curious how different the wording might be. I'm sure you know an evaluation. If you change wording, it just you have to create a whole new crosswalk and figure out, you know, between years how your evaluation compares to each other. So if there are small nuanced differences, you know, how much does that play a role in the difference between two checklists?
Well, it's interesting because I saw your one about drinking water. So in the lesson childcare, it's self-serve. Drink water available inside and outside is the best practice, and so I see the point of sort of that change in terms of referencing the ability of a child to go and serve themselves the water.
Right.
That's a
great point. I mean, we'll look at that too.
I'd love if you do the crosswalk and you're willing to share the effort on that. I'd love to look at it.
Okay.
Any other questions, Morgan?
In your project that you did, you talked a little bit about the findings between differences in the families living in plot A or plot B sections. Have you had an opportunity, what are the next steps, I guess? Do you have an opportunity to share the findings, and is there a way to kind of be able to address the needs of improve access for those families in the plot B region?
That's a very great question, actually, and this was part of our field trip, and I'm not really sure that we'll be going back and continuing this, but this was a suggestion that we gave to our collaborators in Tara Institute, that this is a framework that has been established, and we are understanding that there is a difference in the utilization of child health care services in the authorized plot versus the unauthorized plot, where the population is more. The government is there is not uniform water supply, hygiene education, but still the Anganwadi workers, they are able to go and work in those fields regardless of all the barriers, and they are trying to give more education to those people. So we need to follow up after what needs to happen. We have indicated that there are differences in terms of their access, but this is one of the suggestions that we gave to the Tata Institute people, because they have winter institute interns all the year round from different parts of the globe. So that's a really good question. Yeah.
Anyone else? All right, well, with that, please let us give another round of applause for our presenters this morning, helping to wake us up and get ready for this.